This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Now, Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome. It's Monday, time for our Zoomer Squad. And the holidays can be very tough on caregivers. This, as the latest report from the Ontario Caregiver Organization finds that nearly one in five caregivers took their charge, the person they take care of, to an emergency room simply because they needed a break. And this apparently drove 1.9 million ER visits, costing hospitals an estimated $643 million last year. And on a positive note, I want to talk about my husband, who I have often touted as one of the healthiest people for his age. So he's about to turn 80. I know people look shocked when they hear that, people who know him. And before the weather turned bad, he celebrated with a bike ride of, I think, 125 kilometers. But he had to take his driving test. And this happened last week. And it was actually a pretty amusing story because, as usual, he overprepared, flipping through a 167-page Ministry of Transportation manual. So I'll tell you what happened there. And I know, Anthony, we've talked about those driving tests, and I know you think they're ageist. He was thinking, gee, you know, he wasn't sure they were actually adequate. So we will get to all of that.
And now, time for the Zoomer Squad.
And now I'd like to welcome Anthony Quinn, president of CARP, David Valentin, in studio with chocolates, principal at Liaison Strategies, and Liz West, host of the Afternoon Express. Hi, everyone.
Hi, Libby.
Hello.
Okay, so alarming but not surprising report from the Ontario Caregiver Association. Sometimes, you know, when I see those things, I wonder, how did they really arrive at that? But it doesn't surprise me. Caregiver burnout is a huge thing, and our whole system relies on caregivers. So it doesn't surprise me, Liz.
It doesn't surprise me. Like you, I was kind of wondering, I was playing out the scenario in my head. How does that work? Because everybody who's been to an emergency room knows you're going to walk in and you're going to sit down and maybe be there for a long time before anything even happens. So does the caregiver drop their person off and then, you know, go away for 8 hours and come back and get them? Or I don't really understand the purpose of the use of the emergency room. But I think in general, emergency rooms are overused or used for the wrong reasons. I've always wished we had alternative places to go depending on what your issue is, because the range of problems in one emergency room can go from, I sliced the end of my finger off, or not off, but a little bit, as I've done with cutting bread and chatting at the same time, to someone who's experiencing heart pain, chest pains, or any number of more serious symptoms. So yeah. I hate that the room's full of people like that. And that the people who are working there are navigating, you know, who gets seen first and dealing with everything. And regarding caregiving, I think this is just shining a spotlight on a bigger problem. And that is, yeah, the number of people that are in a position of being a caregiver. And maybe there needs to be more attention paid, not the same way we you pay attention to PSWs and nurses and doctors, but some kind of attention that caregivers are not getting because they feel that they're not seen.
Well, yeah, and there, I mean, it can be a 24/7 job. It's kind of relentless. There's a financial cost to it. People came up with an average that it costs about an average something around $750 a month just to take care of your loved one. Presumably, some people have had to quit their jobs, Anthony. I mean, these are not new revelations.
Certainly not new, but it's going to continue to be one of the biggest problems in our healthcare system as the baby boomers are aging and necessarily coming with more health problems. The caregivers themselves are, if we're talking about caring for older adults, they're most likely to be their spouses and to be aging at the same rate and having less and less capacity to do that. Or alternatively, they're the adult children of these older adults, and they don't have the capacity in their lives with their careers and their children and other expectations on them to be full-time caregivers. So the ER becomes the only option in this healthcare system where you can take dad if he has a condition that you can't cope with, whether you're the spouse or the adult child. And that funnels into this one place we have called the emergency room that also has people who've cut their finger and children with fevers and people with influenza. And that bottleneck at the ER is what CARP brought to Queen's Park a couple of weeks ago and said the crisis is started and the Ontario Caregivers Association is giving more fuel to that fire.
You know, David, it's always been like this. I remember when I first started reporting from Ontario, and it was in, I hate to date myself, in the mid-80s, and the first big series I did was on emergency overcrowding, and it was the same thing. There were all kinds of people there who really didn't quite have emergencies, and the system was plugged up and overused.
Well, and we have to remember that the system punishes family doctors if their patients go to walk-in clinic sometimes. And so you have a system where you're incentivizing people, well, my family doctor will be cross or might drop me if I keep going to
walk-in. Might drop you, yeah.
So let me go to an emergency room instead because I still want someone to take a look at me. And I think the other problem we're seeing is, you know, caregivers should be having some sort of support from the government. This year, we saw a number of actions taken, especially around Home Care Ontario, where for months, people couldn't get access to medical supplies. They needed to be able to do home care. So, you know, I think that's been resolved now with the supply chain issues that they were seeing. The province decided to create a big agency to take care of this. And of course, they couldn't get their act together in time. But, you know, if you are struggling to take care of someone at home and you're used to receiving medical supplies.
That's me.
And then
I do that.
One day it doesn't show up anymore.
Yeah. Or the wrong stuff or it's short.
Yeah.
I could write a novel, a nice 900-page novel on how hard it was and has been to navigate the getting supplies on time, when we need them, and the right stuff. And now there's multiple suppliers, and everybody points a finger at someone else. You've got to call this person. Well, they didn't do that. You got to call them, your nurse, your home care provider, your physician has, you know, and it's as an individual, I always think if I'm struggling, I can't imagine if English is not your first language or you're not digital, you're very analog and you're being told to go online, etc. It's a challenge. It's a massive challenge.
Well, they certainly, when they switched suppliers, they didn't organize it well enough for all that everything in our medical system has so many bureaucrats involved. It's really disheartening. And I have to say that I received medical supplies before this transition. And I always wondered because there was one company and I thought, that must be some contract.
Yeah.
And I had the opposite problem where not only did they deliver on time, but I got too much stuff.
No, Libby,
too much.
I got
too
stuff. Much. I have boxes of things that we would never use. I mean, this is a whole other subject, but seriously, I have so much medical stuff that we didn't order, didn't need, and they won't take back.
Okay,
that
wait,
I wanted to ship it to Ukraine
or
something.
I have a place.
Do you?
Where you can send it to. But it was the same thing. Now, they were right because there was a lot of waste with that other company. And I think part of it was that for the short period that I needed, like a nurse would come in, and they weren't the same person. And, you know, maybe one nurse or PSW likes one thing and the next one likes something else, or one of them put something where the other one couldn't find it.
Yeah.
So there's that. There's that confusion. But I mean, can you?
There's a ton of waste.
There is a ton of waste.
We can, verify it.
You know, I'm a little bit more concerned about the ER bottlenecks. And Libby, you said, you know, it's always been the same. But because there are just so many more people in the funnel coming from the aging of the baby boomers, that I'm really concerned there's going to be an intergenerational fight between that parent of a child who has a fever and saying, why are there 300 seniors in this lineup, and why are they taking up all of the resources?
Well, I mean, I avoid emergencies at all costs.
I've been in the ER a lot lately with my elderly parents.
And are there a lot of older people there? Because
it is full of elderly people. And I've been to two or three Toronto hospitals and Peel hospitals and Halton hospitals.
It is. Yeah,
I remember that when I was on cancer treatment, and the oncologist would say, okay, if this happens, that happens, or that happens, you have to go to the ER. And I'm thinking, over my dead body.
I know.
Forget it.
You have to think long and hard because you know what you're going to be in for.
Yeah.
It's not, you have to be really sick to go.
And Anthony, I have to tell you, you know, we have enough. There are enough people trying to foment intergenerational strife, so don't give anybody any ideas about that.
Well, I think it's just going to be a natural, when you look around the room and you want to blame someone for the situation, and when it's a bunch of silver-haired
blame the
folks,
government.
Well, that's the right person to blame, the right entity to blame, because they haven't prepared for the wave that is here now and only going to continue. Our demographer in the room will be able to verify that. But the spike in the 75-plus Ontarians that are going to need more care just based on all of the things that happen to aging people, from dementia to falls to those comorbidities, there's just going to be so many more of them that the percentages will go up, and the system isn't built for it.
No, and if you look at the long-term care homes, no target has been met in terms of construction. If you look at healthcare capacity, whether it's nursing targets, doctor targets, every target has been missed. A lot of inefficiencies in the healthcare system, but a lot of them have been created sort of on purpose at this point, where you have some nurses being paid one amount by a staffing agency, other nurses being paid other amounts by the hospitals. And no one has full-time work in many cases because they're structuring these things to try to cobble together budgets for hospitals that, you know, they would tell you they're underfunded. And so then we wonder, you know, there's no funding for the hospital, but why is the emergency room so full? So all of these things are interconnected. But I think the government, if they're listening today, could start by saying, let's not punish family doctors for having their patients go to walk-in clinics. If we can get those people out of emergency rooms, it will probably work out for the better.
Well, some of the health teams have their own walk-in clinic. They had anyway. So they have people who are on after hours, where if you're a patient at that health team, you can go. But it's not a free-for-all. I mean, it's at a certain hour. And I'm trying to think if they may have gotten rid of it during the pandemic and brought, I don't know if it's brought back, but there's definitely, there's too much bureaucracy in the system, and that's my take on an awful lot of things, and it leads to a lot of waste.
Part of our benefits plan here at Zoomer Media offers a few calls to Maple for for your free doctor visit that during COVID was paid for by the OHIP program, but no longer is. So I found that to be a terrific way to slow down visits to family doctors, to walk-in clinics and to ERs, because you can get online with a doctor in seconds, minutes. You can upload a photograph of what your ailment is. The doctor can prescribe online. It's just been a terrific addition to, I think,
virtual medicine.
And I think that's the future, but the province has to invest in it. And currently, they're not interested in doing that.
I think the problem is the emergency room, too, is a catch-all, and it's probably more expensive to run.
Of course.
Therefore, I would like to see more specialty options for people, like knowing that a lot of seniors have very similar problems when they come in, breathing, they've fallen, you know, like it's not like...
But that is an emergency.
It is an emergency, but like in my fantasy mind, I fantasize about seniors... I don't know what we'd call them, but like a seniors clinic, 24 hours for seniors who fall or are having respiratory problems. And it would specialize in helping people in the same situation that would take them out of the emergency rooms. Why wouldn't we look at community?
We need more gerontologists, first of all. And there are seniors clinics, but they're not 24 hours.
I've never even heard of a seniors clinic.
Oh, there's one at Toronto General. But
they wouldn't even be in, they don't have to be in a hospital either. They can be outside of a hospital. They don't have to be inside a hospital, which is expensive and hard to get to. And, you know, different, like it's hard to park there. You know, are you calling an ambulance now? Maybe you have a special service. I here I am. I'm fantasizing.
I think you're describing the ER now, where it's mostly seniors.
But this would be just for... You know, seniors, like that's where you go if you're a senior. You're going to a clinic that's set up just for you for 24 hours for these problems.
Well, there are certain things when you do go to the ER that are available to you that are not available to you elsewhere. So, for instance, if you need some kind of imaging, I mean, sometimes they tell you to go to the ER if you can't get a CT scan.
I know. Yeah.
Because you can get a CT scan fast. Mm-hmm. If you're going through the ER, and the thing is, you might need one.
I know someone who just did that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a workaround.
So there are a lot of things to think through. But this kind of funnel that ends up in the emergency room has been a feature of our system for decades.
Yeah,
I'm just saying. For decades, it can be worse now, but it's been that way for decades. And the solution, I mean, dribs and drabs. The province is putting some more money to home care, and more money to health teams.
And education would help to explain what the purpose of the emergency room is, and so that
people
don't go.
It.
Yeah, well, but we have to work on that. We really have to understand when do you go to the emergency room and when you don't. You know, we have the health line you can call. Yeah. 99% of the time they tell us to go to emergency because they're afraid that they could be wrong. And if you don't go to emergency, they're going to be liable. So
they
tell you to go.
You're talking about education. How many times do we harp on, even if this year wasn't a perfect match, get a flu shot? How many people... ending up in the emergency have not had a flu shot? What are the kind of excuses, even for people who are not vaccine hesitant?
Mm-hmm.
How often have I heard, I'd never get a flu shot, I don't need it, that. Yeah,
and, I know, it's frustrating.
And people are getting really, really sick, and they are clogging up the emergency rooms now. Anyway, let's move along. Let's talk about Doug.
I'm so impressed by this bike ride.
Oh, he's biked like 4,000 kilometers over the season.
Wow.
He's a maniac, but he was debating whether he should go into, there's some kind of study on super agers, and he becomes eligible at his 80th, and he's thinking, should I go in this?
Sure. What's a super ager?
is somebody who ages in a super way and is probably way fitter than you or me.
That sounds very prestigious.
Oh, yeah. They have these studies on who are these, like, you've heard of, I mean, the marathon guy who's 99 years old and those people.
Right.
Yeah. So he had to take this driving test. And he always over-prepares, like, that's him. So he flipped through the 167-page manual from the Ministry of Transportation, even though, you know, the government website says all you have to do is watch this video. And he shows up to this place, and there were two things. So first was a visual test, and it wasn't even reading a chart. It was lights shining on either side, I think in peripheral vision, and there's a person there monitoring it, just say, tell us when you see the flashing light. So that took about 2 minutes. And then there's the clock, which is a classic test for dementia, where they give you a clock and you have to put the hands on the clock. And I remember Doug's mother did it when she had Alzheimer's, and the hands on the clock, like, she couldn't even put them anywhere near the clock. He said, he thought maybe in case if he'd get nervous or something, he was cheating because he set his analog watch to the time, which is 10 past 11, so in case he had to look down. But the whole thing took 5 minutes. Like, he's a great driver. And, of course, they can tell you need to take a road test. But I know, Anthony, you've said you think the whole thing is ageist. But he said he didn't think it was adequate to catch any people who should not be driving.
It certainly is adequate, because the intention of the test for over 80 is to find those signs of cognition decline. And whether it's drawing the hands on a clock or choosing the letters out of a selection of letters, those are the two things that are flags. And that flag leads you for further assessment with your own doctor and may lead to a suspension in the immediate or once the doctor has reassessed for cognitive. So if someone has been driving along fine, but they don't remember to circle all the letter K in the paragraph, that could be a sign that even though their physical skills are great, their cognitive skills are declining. And I don't think I've said on behalf of CARP that the test is ageist. My bigger concern is when someone over age 65 gets into an at-fault accident, whether or not they've been convicted, they immediately get their license suspended until such time as you pass these tests and take a road test again. So that is the big issue in Ontario. Is if you are over 65 and are in an at-fault accident, even if you haven't gone to court, you can get a letter from the ministry saying you've been in an accident, your license is suspended, and until such time, you have 60 days to take a remediation test or driving test, you don't get your license back.
I didn't even know that.
I didn't know.
So that's the
big
issue.
This is an assumption that this might be a cognitive issue.
And it's based on your age. So if you're 64 and get into the fender bender, it's just an insurance claim. Or something to do with the court, or with the courts. Wow. And if you're 65 plus, the ministry is paying attention.
Wow.
Well, I think, listen, it's if you're 64 and you're listening to this now, you might be saying, what happens when I turn 65? I think, you know, not having the data in front of me, I hope there's a valid reason that they're picking 65 as a number, right? And I hope that this system...
They always have, since the time of Otto von Bismarck.
But you hope that the system is working in the way it needs to, which is that some people are being taken off the road who are being identified, and it's effective in finding some people who legitimately maybe shouldn't get their license back. But you wonder if the age has to be moved, because people are aging differently now, and if the science isn't the same, sticking to 65 because it's a pretty round number doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
That's the number for pensions, and it used to be the enforced retirement number. Mm-hmm. And, what we keep saying is 65 isn't what it used to be, at least not for most people.
Yeah, although I don't know if that's the same when it comes to your cognition. Like, I think we can, you know, nip and tuck and would play tennis and ride bikes, but I don't know how you I mean, your brain, I've noticed a difference in my cognitive abilities. I'm not that age yet, but I'm just saying I've noticed a change, you know, for women. It can be in menopause. You know, you can have chemo brain, menopause brain, baby brain when you're a new mom. Like, there's all these different things that can affect. Wait, those are, why is it just the women who are suffering? Too much hairspray, inhalation brain? That's
No, that's what I have.
I might have that. But honestly, like, there is a difference. So I think 65, I don't know why we would change. I'm fine with that happening if that happens to me. Maybe I do need to have a little check-in to make sure I am okay. I don't think it's going to be a problem, but...
Well, yeah, and we know, and this is for another conversation, that one of the toughest conversations is when you've got to take the car keys away from a family member.
Yeah.
That is not a happy event, well, usually.
And this is one of the ways in which the system, through the administrative process, takes the keys away from folks. So it... Grandma got into a fender bender. She backed into someone. It was her fault. The system is actually taking away her license until she can prove she's worthy again.
Okay. Unfortunately, we have no time, and it's getting to feel a lot like Christmas, even though the snow's gone. So let me go around, and I wish you all a Merry Christmas. It's great to have you here in studio. This should happen more often, and I'm going to give you a chance to give our listeners a Merry Christmas, each one of you, starting with Anthony.
Well, on behalf of the Canadian Association of Retired Persons and all of our members across the country, Libby, Merry Christmas to everyone here around the table and our listeners. It's been a pleasure being on your show all year, and looking forward to more next year.
Yep.
Thank you, and a happy last day of Hanukkah. Am I right?
Yesterday.
Was it yesterday?
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm a little late with that. And happy holidays to everybody here, and everybody's listening. It's been a great year, and let's hope that 2026 is even a little bit better. That's what I'd like to say.
Better than
2025.
I don't think that's tough. That's a tough
is that much
thing to be.
Not much to do.
No, not for the world. David, last.
Well, let me wish everyone a Merry Christmas, and I hope you spend it with someone you love. Feliz Navidad to all, and have a great 2026.
Okay. On that note, we wrap things up. Thank you, David, Liz, and Anthony. Merry Christmas. We're taking a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about traveling and whether people are cutting back on going to the States like they say they are.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Oh, no. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Well, are you planning to travel sometime soon? And is the U.S. on your list of destinations? Are you still trying to avoid America because of the Trump trade war and everything else that's happening there? Well, according to the latest poll, 62% of respondents said they were less likely to travel to the U.S. than they were a year ago. And a separate Ipsos poll found that 6 in 10 said they could never trust the U.S. in the same way again. So we would like to hear from you. And let me give you our text line. 866-740-4740. Again, that's 866-740-4740. You can text us. Unfortunately, the elves are still messing with our phone lines. But hey, text is the 21st century way anyway. And I'm now joined by Devin Perry of Devin Perry Travel and Stephen Fine, president and managing editor at snowbirdadvisor.ca. Welcome to both of you. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having me, Libby.
Okay, let me begin with Stephen, actually. So I have to say that the snowbirds I know, especially if they have made some kind of financial commitment to a place in Florida, well, virtually every single one of them is going, even though sometimes they grumble about it.
See, that's absolutely right. I mean, that's what we've seen from we did a survey recently of our Snowbird Advisor members, and most snowbirds who go to the U.S. are going to continue to go to the U.S., although we do see some decline happening this year.
And what is the level of decline? How much?
Well, last year, 82% of snowbirds went to the U.S., and this year, 70% of snowbirds are going to the U.S. So a 12-point decline, which translates to a 15% decrease in travel to the U.S., which is, it's not insignificant, but it's a lot less than what we're seeing in other travel segments to the U.S.
Okay. Devin, what are you finding?
So I ran a similar poll, and I would say those numbers are pretty much in line with short-term and sort of medium-length travel as well. I work with 1,700 other advisors, and I think that different types of travelers and different segments of people, the numbers sort of range quite differently. I have people that canceled trips when the tariffs were in place. I have people that have chosen to go to London and Paris versus traveling to the U.S., but I also just booked an extensive amount of U.S. travel within the past couple of weeks.
Yeah, I mean,
so I think it's across the board, but it definitely is down. That is an absolute fact.
I mean, I remember at the beginning of all this, people were all gung-ho. We were avoiding U.S. produce at the grocery store. And in some grocery stores, I mean, it was hard to even find. But I think there's been a lot of, backsliding on that note, where people are just more conscious of convenience and of price. And, you know, I'm wondering if it's the same thing with travel, Devin. So have you seen that people who were maybe gung-ho a few months ago are now saying, oh, you know what, if I get a deal to Florida, then I'll take the deal to Florida?
Absolutely. I think it's the rational and emotional parts of our brain in competition with each other. It's easy to say, I won't travel to the U.S. when it's warm outside, or you don't have your friend's 50th birthday that's being held there, or family that you want to visit. But sort of as those needs change, I think that sort of that, you know, really strong moral compass that you're feeling may sort of be put aside to your immediate needs. I was at the airport on Friday in the U.S. terminal, and I assure you that it was as busy as it ever has been around this time of year. And I think that different traveler types can fulfill their U.S. travel in different ways. Other people have things that they want to do in the U.S. that there isn't a alternative solution to do that.
Yeah, I mean, it's also, I've heard, one of the things I've heard people say, and this doesn't apply to snowbirds, is that they say, okay, I'll go to so-called blue states. I'll go to New York. I'll go to California. So they're not on side with everything that the Trump administration's doing. Have you seen any evidence of that, Stephen?
Well, we haven't seen too much of that on the snowbird side. And remember, snowbirds are very different travelers than short-term travelers. They have different needs, different travel patterns. They're really going to live somewhere for the winter. So they have unique ties to the U.S. in many cases that a lot of other short-term travelers don't have. For example, you know, they own property, which was mentioned earlier. So if you own a property, you're probably not going to let it sit empty for the winter. And about 30% of snowbirds own their property. In addition, we know from our members that about 70% of snowbirds who go to the U.S. drive down there. So if you want to drive somewhere and you want to have your car with you, you don't really have another option than going to the U.S. And the third big factor is people are going down to see friends and family and communities where they've spent years and years, and they're spending 3, 4, 5, 6 months down there. They're attached to those communities more so than someone who's just going somewhere for a week or a weekend. So they have a much a deeper attachment to many of the U.S. Snowbird destinations, regardless of whether it's a blue state or a red state.
It's interesting. I mean, did you get any reaction The last thing that the governor of Florida, DeSantis, said is like, we don't need those Canadians. We're doing just fine. Does that put people's back up or what?
I think that it obviously, you know, definitely strikes a chord and people may take offense to it. But I don't know if it's to the level where they're going to not go to Florida.
And Devin, so what are you, you know, I was surprised that people are picking what I would call cold weather destinations like Europe as an alternative to going to a warm weather destination in the U.S.
I think it's interesting. So I think it's, you know, easy if you're a grandparent and you want to take your kids and grandkids on a trip to say, we're going to go to Italy this year instead of Disneyland. What's not easy is people that travel 4, 5, 6 times a year that are already doing that European trip or that Asian trip that like to get away frequently and want to go somewhere for 4 days. There's not really a substitute for New York. There's not really a substitute for Palm Springs in Canada. And then, you know, you're not going to substitute a 4-day trip for something that's further away. I have seen a lot of Christmas vacations this year heading to places in South America that I think maybe would have done a Florida or a California trip to still try and get some warm weather. I'm not seeing people go to Europe like for the cold weather instead of going to the US.
What about Mexico?
Mexico seems to be the same as it normally is.
The same. So they didn't pick up any of the slack from people not going to the States. I'm surprised by that.
Holiday season is probably driving that a little bit just because the prices are at such a premium. You're going to spend more money there. So if you can do something like I would normally go to Florida, but I'm going to go to Colombia, as different as those two places are, you're getting warmer weather and you're getting similar pricing if you're not someone that's looking to go to an all-inclusive vacation.
Uh-huh. And I am... Here is a text from Susan. Unfortunately, I have no interest in traveling to the U.S., she writes. I have a son who lives in Texas, but he comes here rather than us going there. I truly support Canadian and travel to Europe in November rather than going to the U.S. So I say, Susan, good for you. But I think Susan is probably unusual. Am I wrong, Devin?
I'm actually seeing a lot of people with similar sort of dialogue to that. So there are people that, you know, are putting their wallet where their mouth is and choosing to not go to the U.S. I have clients that have their kids that live in the U.S. come up to Canada and visit them instead. There are quite a lot of people that have chosen simply, I will not visit the U.S. I don't know how much of those people would have traveled to the U.S. to begin with, because I see a lot more of that conviction coming with more sort of adventure travelers, if you will, anyways, that are probably not going to the more popular destinations like Las Vegas or cities like New York or Dallas or Austin. They are people that are going to go somewhere a little bit more exotic. But I do definitely think that there is a core group of people that really have a lot of conviction right now and they're standing to it. They do not want to have their money being spent in the U.S. right now.
Another thing that I saw, a recent push from tourism authorities in Jamaica, where they had a horrible hurricane recently, saying, hey, people, come support us and we're OK. We're back in business. And actually, I was just talking to a travel agent who said, oh, she's not sure that they're actually ready. So, Devin, what's your take on Jamaica?
For the most part, the tourism areas that people visit, Montego Bay, are in pretty great shape. Resorts open pretty fast. There's insurance involved with a lot of cases. So people closed, not necessarily because there was damage, but just sort of make sure that like logistical things were in place. There was a sort of large group of travel agents that went down there a couple weeks ago. And everything that I'm hearing from colleagues, I was not a part of it, is that other certain areas that are completely closed, you don't have the option to go there anyways. Are not open, but the places that are open are absolutely operational.
Okay, let us take a text from Jerry. And it says, To consolidate my rant in February for those seeking warmer climes, Cuba is an interesting option. They've experienced difficult time, but they're lovely people who appreciate Canadians, and we can enhance their economy going forward. Olé. So, Cuba. Are people choosing Cuba? I've always kind of considered it a lower-priced option, and the food's not great.
In Cuba,
yeah,
they have some infrastructural issues that impact experiences there in a lot of cases. So we don't advise against not going to Cuba as agents, but we are very clear on sort of the expectations that you'll have.
Mm-hmm. And Stephen, do you see snowbirds starting to look at property in other places? I know snowbirds who, for instance, got property in Costa Rica.
It's definitely becoming more popular. We are aware of people buying properties, but in terms of general travel to international destinations, there is a big increase this year. That same survey that I cited before, we also found that there's the number of snowbirds going to international destinations this year almost doubled from last year. So last year, about 13% of snowbirds went to destinations, international destinations, and this year 24% are going to international destinations. So quite a big increase from last year to this year.
Uh-huh. And do you expect that to keep going, or do you think that if things get a little steadier in the States or settle down a bit, do you think that will, go back to where it was?
It's hard to tell at this point. I mean, we'll be able to tell a little bit better in the next couple of years. I think definitely we're going to see more snowbirds going to international destinations. Whether we see big jumps like this in the future is hard to tell, because we did ask another question to our snowbird advisor members, asking them, those who went to the U.S. last year but are not going back to the U.S. this year, we asked them if they would consider going back to the U.S. in the future, and 54% of them said they would consider going back to the U.S. in the future.
Okay. On that note, we wrap things up. Merry Christmas to you both, and thank you so much, Devin Perry and Stephen Fine. Bye-bye. And, there's that sound. We're taking a break, and when we come back, boy, late Friday, we learned that three terrorism suspects were arrested. They were arrested quite a while ago. There was a foiled plot. They were planning hate-motivated incidents against Jews and against women, and inspired by ISIS, by Islamic radicalism. We'll talk about that when we come back.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Well, less than a week after the anti-Semitic massacre on Bondi Beach in Australia, police announced the arrest of three Toronto men who have been charged with hate-motivated crimes targeting women and the Jewish community. Well, one of the things very interesting about this to me is that this announcement was made late Friday. However, the arrests were made back on November 26th. And I'm, in addition to being curious about what went down there, I am also very curious about the timing of the announcement, because it does sound a little strange to me. So to talk about this, we have two terrorism experts. We've got Phil Gursky and we have Ward. I'm sorry, my script seems to be weird. Ward Elcock, sorry about that. Welcome and thank you both for joining us. So Let's begin with Phil. Let's talk about the timing. So what do you think is behind the timing?
Oh, it's a great question. Obviously, the police involved were aware that a crime could have been committed, was in the offing. That's why they made the arrest. But I think it's important to remind your listeners, Libby, that information keeps coming in. Investigations don't stop once the arrests have been made. So they found out more information once these men were in custody. What I find interesting is that out of the three, only one's been charged with terrorism, i.e. Islamic State or ISIS-inspired. The other two have been charged with hate crimes. So it seems to be a bit of a mixed bag here. The fact that the announcement took place after the Bondi Beach attack is probably part to play there, because that was definitely an ISIS-inspired attack. So there seemed to be, obviously, and you know as well as I do, Libby, we talked about this in the past, there are ISIS-inspired people here in Canada. So maybe that explains in part the timing of the announcement.
Ward, what is a more serious or difficult to prove charge, terrorism or hate?
Well, I think both of them are actually fairly hard to prove. It's always, in some sense, easier to, I'm a lawyer by background, it's almost always easier to charge somebody and prosecute them for a straightforward criminal offense, whether it's attempted murder or attempted theft or whatever, than it is to prove either hate or terrorism. So you do need a fair amount of evidence for those charges. And having leveled those charges, presumably they have some pretty decent evidence. But as Phil said, this is a fairly mixed bag of people.
Do you have any thoughts about why they would have held on to the news of this arrest for really quite a while and then announce it on the Friday before Christmas, just after the Bondi Beach massacre?
Well, I suppose it does make you wonder if they were looking for some publicity for it. But as Phil said, investigations don't stop the moment somebody's arrested. And just because you've arrested somebody doesn't mean you actually have much of a real case to make. It may take some more investigation before you get to the point where you can actually announce something. So I wouldn't actually read that much into it one way or the other. At most, it may be simply a desire to get a little bit of publicity for it. But other than that, I think it's just the investigative process.
Okay, I'm going to read out the names of the suspects. So one is 26-year-old Waleed Khan. Another is Osman Azizov, 18 years old, and Fahad Sadat, who is 19, and almost 80 charges together. And this charge of attempted to kidnap women, Jewish women, and there were two foiled kidnapping attempts. Is that unusual, Phil?
Not necessarily, Libby. People inspired, either members of or inspired by Islamist extremist groups, have been kidnapping for a long time. Think of Robert Fowler and Louis Gay, taken by Al-Qaeda in Africa years ago. Think of the Chibok girls in Nigeria, taken in 2014, some of whom are still in captivity by Boko Haram in Islamic State. Al-Shabaab has been keeping a Kenyan pastor as a kidnapped victim for over a year and a half now. It is a tactic that they use. The fact they would try it in broad daylight is a little bit interesting to me, suggests maybe a lack of professionalism or a lack of capability. But I think the end of the day, kudos to the police. These attacks were foiled. These men are now in custody, and we'll see what happens going forward. As Ward says, we're still collecting information about the actual motivation, and I'm with him. It's much, much easier to prove actus reus than mens rea. And to get the actual reason why they did this, that's going to take a lot more time.
Mm-hmm. And they were apparently arrested with quite the cache of weapons. And where would these weapons have come from, in your opinion, Ward?
Depends what kind of weapons they were. I mean, it isn't impossible, unfortunately, to acquire lethal weapons in Canada, even though there are lots of restrictions on guns, etc. There are illegal guns, and it is possible for criminals to procure them, unfortunately. But if it's not clear what exactly the weapons were, I mean, they could simply have been knives or a collection of other implements. it isn't, there's a lot that really isn't clear yet about this. I mean, as Phil said, only one of these individuals is actually being charged with terrorism offenses. It almost sounds like the other two were almost more motivated against women than simply anything else. It would appear that one of them must have had some online connection to ISIS or ISIS material or reading ISIS material or whatever. Only when we actually see the prosecution in court will we know to what level his connection to ISIS had really gone, or was it just simply curiosity that had taken him at least into the ISIS world, which is, ISIS has lived online like a lot of other organizations in the world for a long time.
Just last week, we were talking about lone wolf attacks and the difficulty of finding them. So I think it seems pretty clear that this was ISIS inspired, but would this appear, Phil, to be another lone wolf or lone wolves, lone trio attack?
Again, as Warren said, it's really hard to tell with the information we don't have right now. It's also interesting how the RCMP and Peel and Toronto Police got onto them in the first place. Was it part of another investigation? Was it part of their, you know, trolling on social media to see who's out there and who's saying what to whom? We need to know an awful lot more. But, you know, what worries me, Libby, is people seem to think that, you know, these lone actor attacks are somehow less lethal or less dangerous in nature than attacks that are carried out or planned by groups like ISIS or Al-Qaeda. They're not. We've seen lots of lone actors, you know, kill dozens of people around the world. And so let's not dismiss this just because it seems to be one individual. But again, you know, Christmas is coming up, and I you know, tip my hat to the police officers and the teams that found these people. And as a consequence, nobody was injured. So we owe them a debt of gratitude in that sense.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, Christmas and New Year's are often high value targets, as people in your business would say, Ward.
Yes, that's true. I mean, it usually, often organizations like that are looking for occasions that are of some significance in an attack, or some facility that's of note, or a city that's of note. So, yeah, they're looking for notoriety. And you get more notoriety if you do it at Christmas time than if you do it on the August long weekend when everybody's at the cottage.
Uh-huh. And I mean, there's also, I guess, a religious aspect of that Christmas is, you know, main holiday of Christianity.
I think there's something to that. Go ahead, Ward.
Yeah, although it's not entirely clear in this case that all of them were motivated by religion or sectarian whatever. It's clear one of them was at least trolling the internet, as far as we know, at least trolling on the internet for ISIS and so on. But we're still a long way from knowing very much about these three and what exactly motivated them and how deep they were into an ISIS milieu. But as Phil said, good thing that they were picked up early. So if it was to develop further, it didn't go farther.
Well,
they were picked up in time.
They are set to appear in court January 29th, so hopefully we learn more then. In the meantime, I would like to wish you both a very Merry Christmas, and thank you so much for your insight, which is really helpful, Ward Elcock and Phil Gursky.
Pleasure, Libby. Have a good holiday.
Okay,
pleasure.
You too.
Have a good holiday.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye. And that is all the time we have for Fight Back for today. I'm Libby Znaimer, and I will be back here tomorrow, and we'll talk then.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.